There's this great quote from Posidonius. He said, "The cause of emotions, that is, of disharmony and the unhappy life," I think emotions there, he means pathos, "the cause of them is that men fail to be wholly consistent in following the daimon within them, the daimon, or spirit, that is akin to and of like nature with the power governing the whole universe."
Welcome to Stoic Conversations. My name is Caleb Ontiveros, and today I'm speaking with Alex Petkas, the founder and host of the Cost of Glory podcast. This is our second conversation. Thanks for returning.
Great to be back, Caleb.
Awesome. So today we're going to be talking about two great figures from ancient Roman history, Posidonius, a Stoic, and Pompey, a military leader, statesman, and use these two characters as a entry point into thinking about Stoic philosophy and, of course, Roman history generally. So we're going to be talking about two key figures from ancient Roman history, Posidonius, a Stoic, and Pompey, a statesman, a famous general. And I wanted to open with a line from Seneca about Posidonius, and we'll start with it, talking about his life, who he was, because he is a lesser known Stoic. We just don't have that many of his writings, unfortunately, but he is someone who Seneca was familiar with and indeed encouraged his friends, readers to read. So here it is. "Live with Chrysippus, with Posidonius. They'll make you acquainted with things earthly and things heavenly. They'll bid you work hard over something more than neat turns of language and phrases mouthed forth for the entertainment of listeners. They will bid you be stout of heart and rise superior to threats. The only harbor safe from the seething storms of this life is the scorn of the future, a firm stand, a readiness to receive fortune's missiles full in the breast, neither skulking nor turning back." So I think that's a
man.
That's what a line. What a Seneca at his best.
Yes. And,
yeah. Some serious encouragement to, you know, read Chrysippus, read Posidonius, and not just read them, but live with them.
Yeah. I love that line. And Posidonius, it's funny, you know, he says it's more than just pretty phrases you're going to learn from these guys. But Posidonius was also famous for actually being one of the Stoics who could write, and unlike his buddy Chrysippus, well, not his buddy, you know, Chrysippus was a century earlier or so. But he, you know, he was a man who lived his beliefs, but also had a very practical life that was itself, I think, worthy of emulation. So that's one of the reasons I find Posidonius so fascinating.
Yeah. What's the world he grew up in?
So Posidonius is, and we'll get to Pompey in a little bit, but he's a little older than Pompey by about, 30 years or so. So Posidonius grows up in Apamea in Syria. He's a Greek living in one of these Greek cities in Syria. And he ends up being this figure, though, of international repute coming from this backwater in Syria. He ends up being somebody that the great classicist and scholar of religion, Arthur Darby Knock, called a sort of Goethe figure of his day. Hmm. He's a polymath. He's a traveler. He's a writer. He's a political advisor. He meets some of the most important people of his day. So sometime when he's a young man, he falls in love with philosophy, I guess. He makes his way to Rhodes, this island off the coast of Turkey, and there he meets Panaetius, the great Stoic of the previous generation. And meeting Panaetius, I think, is really important for Posidonius' story, because Panaetius is kind of in the tradition of Diogenes of Babylon before him, one of these figures who met a lot of the great figures of his day. He was found his way to Rome. Panaetius did, and met Scipio Aemilianus, that's Africanus the Younger, and was kind of an advisor to him. He went on diplomatic missions with Scipio. He met a lot of Scipio's intimates. So Panaetius is one of the members of this famed Scipionic circle that was, at least in Cicero's eyes and Plutarch's eyes, just a huge influence on Roman politics and bringing Stoicism to Rome and kind of translating it, making it cool and interesting to the Roman elites, like Scipio, like Scipio's friend Rutilius Rufus, Gaius Laelius. Another person that was really important in Posidonius's story that's in the Scipionic circle is Polybius, the historian, not just historian, but Polybius is also a political philosopher. He wrote the histories of his time, of the entire Mediterranean world from the First Punic War up until his day. And Polybius, Book 6, is his famous treatment of the Roman Constitution that was read extensively and carefully by the U.S. founding fathers. So, you know, that's Panaetius's world.
Yeah.
And, you know, he eventually retires to Rhodes, and it's like this world that Panaetius kind of initiates Posidonius into, first as a student, and I think later through his connections, Posidonius is able to make a trip to Rome himself, which has interesting fruit from it.
Yeah, yeah. I think of Panaetius as exactly one of these figures who bring Stoicism to the Romans. And by doing that, it doesn't change the nature of Stoicism, but changes some of the key focuses, I think. And you can see it in their lives, where these are statesman type figures. They're thinking more about how you live that life well, and bringing the tools of Stoicism to the kinds of problems or questions that might emerge in that role. So one example of that is that we've talked on this podcast before about Epictetus's role ethics. And Panaetius had an early form of that Epictetus was developing, which is, you know, not so much thinking about virtues as abstract type things, although they did that as well, but trying to make that bring, you know, the tools of philosophy to some of these concrete questions about what does it look like to be excellent in my roles? How do I choose these roles? And so on, which I think is one of the innovations one gets in Stoicism, the Roman kind of Stoicism in particular.
Yeah. And I mean, some of the earlier Stoics, it's like all you could squeeze out of them as far as political philosophy goes is, oh, the wise man is the only one worthy to rule the state. Full stop. Yeah. So what does that mean? Like, what does that role really look like? You know, the hard decisions you have to make. I think people like Panaetius, maybe Diogenes of Babylon, certainly Panaetius and definitely Posidonius are really trying to kind of flesh that out for the people that are turning to them for advice, who are, you know, overwhelmingly the elites of their cities, the Roman nobles especially. So yeah, I think of it as like a translation of Stoic philosophy, kind of fleshing out of its practical implications.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So then Posidonius, do we know why he became a philosopher? Like, what drew him to Stoicism as opposed to some other school? These kinds of questions.
That's a good question. And I'm not an expert on everything Posidonius, but what I do know is he had this famous reputation for being a polymath. And, you know, I think it might have something, I wonder if it might have something to do with the Stoics' appreciation of nature. Posidonius was fascinated by kind of everything, but he made this kind of research tour all the way to Cadiz in Spain and studied the tides there. He measured the size of the sun and the moon and was interested in astronomy. I think you could see that as an outgrowth of his belief in the importance of nature and understanding it and all of its aspects and how it kind of bears on human conduct. So I wonder if it might have something to do with that. But however he ended up getting interested in Stoicism, he was not a super doctrinaire Stoic. There's an interesting quote I think this is Galen. Whereas other Stoics are prepared to betray their fatherland rather than their dogmas, Posidonius is prepared to betray the Stoic school rather than the truth. So that was Galen's take on Posidonius, who he really admired. And I think you see that spirit of always questioning and experimenting through all of his writings, both his the fragments that we have, both the natural philosophy aspects, but also his inquiry into human nature. So, and we'll get to his interaction with the Romans in a second, but one of his great literary achievements was a history of his times. He's the only philosopher that we know of that wrote an extensive history of his times, mm-hmm. at least up to his period. And he basically wrote a continuation of Polybius. And again, I think that's in that spirit of, as one ancient rhetorician put it, history is philosophy by examples. So Posidonius is very much that guy. And I think that desire to find great examples mm-hmm. and to see human nature pushed to its limits in the careers and characters of the powerful is one of the things that attracted him to Rome and got him involved with people like Gaius Marius and Sulla.
Yeah, yeah. The point about nature is an interesting one as one of the driving forces of what could attract him to Stoicism, you know, being that he is a polymath interested in natural science, but also history. And I wonder if part of that attraction to Stoicism is perhaps its systematic nature, which is, and its focus on those three domains, you know, the physics, logic, and ethics.
And right. All of them being kind of expressions of a kind of coherent metaphysics of the cosmos grounded by nature.
Right, right. And perhaps in some of its earlier forms, you would have seen that essentially turn into logic and metaphysics. But perhaps what another more Roman spin on it is including much more of investigation into sort of the natural world, the day-to-day particularities of the social world as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Cool. Well, do you want to introduce our other character?
Well, let's get to Pompey in a second. It's important to understand what Pompey is coming from when he meets Posidonius. So when Posidonius is at Rome, he witnesses famously the beginning of the Roman Civil War. That is really important for Pompey's story. And just to give you a kind of précis of what's going on, there's this Roman general, Gaius Marius, who is in the 80s BC, kind of getting on in years, but the greatest man at Rome. He was a populist, kind of outsider to the aristocratic nobility. And a war breaks out in the east, and the Senate awards the command to this other politician, Sulla, who is Marius's former protege. But Sulla is just a diehard aristocrat and the conservative optimate faction. And so they have a falling out. Marius basically tries through some constitutional alchemy to strip Sulla of his command, and Sulla reacts by marching on Rome and capturing the city, declaring Gaius Marius a public enemy. This is like the first step of the first Roman Civil War, which happens in the 80s. And then Sulla goes east to fight his war, thinking everything's fine. But Gaius Marius makes a comeback, and he's back. Yeah. And he's after blood, and he recaptures the city, and he slaughters many of his enemies, not nearly as many as Sulla did later. But so Posidonius meets Marius kind of on his deathbed and tells the story as Plutarch, Marius's biographer, recounts that basically Marius had this fever that ended his life, and it kind of made him hallucinate. And like, even in his last days, he was sort of hallucinating and fantasizing about, you know, commanding armies and ordering around his servants, like, march up the hill, you know, just kind of crazy old man completely driven, delusional by his own ambition, by his insatiable thirst for glory. And, you know, Posidonius would have considered that an expression of kind of our lower nature as opposed to our higher nature. And so Marius was like a great example of how the thirst for power can corrupt your soul. So he meets Marius there. He meets maybe he meets Sulla. He ends up befriending Cicero later. But you know, all this to say that Posidonius, by the time that Pompey meets him, and this is several years later, he's already developed this reputation as being one of the wisest men in the Mediterranean. His writings are circulating. He's traveled widely. He's already been to Rome. He gets these people. And so it's in 67 BC that Pompey finally meets Posidonius. And I guess we should probably tell the story of why Pompey is on the island of Rhodes meeting Posidonius and what's at stake there.
Yeah, what's he doing there?
So Pompey is one of Rome's golden boys. He's a promising young politician general. He's around in his late 30s, I think, at the time that he meets Posidonius. And he's been entrusted with this extraordinary command by the Romans against the pirates. Rome is facing this huge threat. There's this Mediterranean-wide pirate problem. They're seizing ships. They're terrorizing local inhabitants. They're marching in on land and raiding. And it sort of seems, in the way that Plutarch describes it, it seems like these guys are kind of organized. And maybe in their eyes, they're not pirates at all, but freedom fighters. And but they're sailing all around the Mediterranean. And the last straw for the Romans is the various commanders have failed to get the problem under control. But the pirates in 67, they get so bold that they sail into the port of Ostia at Rome, and they burn the ships, and they've also captured consuls' daughters, and it's just egregious. And so the Roman people vote this very unprecedented, extraordinary command to Pompey as their greatest general of the time to control basically the whole Mediterranean Sea with just 400 ships, which is a huge number, as many resources and troops as he needs to get the job done. And so Pompey, in very short order, he clears the pirates of the Western Mediterranean. But that's kind of the easy part, because as everybody knows, the pirates have their bases, their kind of hives in the east and in Cilicia especially, but also in places like Crete and Syria, Phoenicia. But so Pompey, in the middle of his pirate campaign, he takes the time to go meet Posidonius to consult his wisdom. And Plutarch describes this scene. Plutarch, of course, Pompey's biographer. He describes a scene where Pompey arrives in Rhodes and he comes into the theater as Posidonius is lecturing on some logical problem. And he just sits down to listen. But what Pompey's really there for is Posidonius's political wisdom, which I think is really important to consider. Like, Posidonius was seen as somebody who could really help you solve your problems if you're a politician, not just your ethical problems, but your political problems. And so together they cook up a kind of a scheme. At least that's how a lot of scholars interpret what's going on here, where, and this gets into Posidonius's political philosophy.
Yeah, yeah.
As a Stoic, which I think is really interesting. You probably have talked about cosmopolitanism a fair bit on this mm-hmm. show. So Posidonius believes that humans are all united by a common participation in the logos. We have a common kind of interest in nature, and that human beings, as he says, are not wild and piratical and vicious by nature, but can become accustomed to be that way through circumstance. And like wild animals, some of them can be tamed out of their wilder states. And I think he presses that point home to Pompey. But another point that he's pressing home as a very learned historian of these regions in its recent history is, you know, these men that are sailing around raiding the Romans are not just brigands. They're not just thugs. These are actually some of the leading citizens of their cities in former years. They're from great families with noble lineages. They have a real sense of themselves. They're very talented. They're very organized. And if things had been different, they might not have become pirates. Because Rome has been waging these wars in the East with Mithridates for decades, and these ravages and displacements, poverty, tragedy, famine that comes from war. The Roman tax collectors are often abusive and driving these people out of their inheritance. So Posidonius kind of fleshes out this picture for Pompey, I think. And Pompey develops this really unique strategy to try something different. But I think one of these signs that Posidonius kind of knows how to deal with these great men and their great egos, when Pompey is leaving Rhodes to go execute on the plan that they've come up, you know, he says, any last advice, my friend? And Posidonius quotes a line of Homer that sums up the heroic code. He says, Ayen aristoein kai peruchon emenai alon. Always be the best and hold your head high above others. He's like kind of telling Pompey, go out there and kick butt and you know, be like a Homeric hero. So I love that kind of humane expansiveness of Posidonius's ability to motivate people. Just really, really signature of his.
Yeah, that's awesome. The use of cosmopolitanism, which is in a sense this doctrine that, look, we're all human beings. That means we share a common nature. We're all rational. And you know, Posidonius is saying, essentially, Pompey, like, put this into practice. You know, these pirates who are acting like, you know, primitive barbarians seem apparently irrational to the Romans, have some logic behind their actions. And you can see that in their circumstances and their history. You know, some of these pirates, as you say, would have been, you know, excellent statesmen, and in fact would be excellent allies with the Romans. And I like that a lot, because it makes cosmopolitanism into something so practical, but also context specific. Like, you have this sort of universal idea that needs to be applied in a way that's mindful of history and circumstances.
Yeah. And in a way, it's not this fuzzy, everybody gets a blue ribbon philosophy at all. It's a very kind of realpolitik philosophy in a lot of ways. In this circumstance, at least, mm-hmm. you know, Pompey doesn't want to sacrifice more troops than he has to. He wants to make the most of the talent that he has. And, you know, if he could make an ally of somebody rather than destroying them, that might actually, he could see that there's a real cost benefit calculus that works in the favor of such a plan. And so that's exactly what he does. You know, he has to rough him up a little bit, and he wins some battles. He captures a, you know, scary fortress on the south coast of Cilicia in Turkey, Korakesion. There's a siege, but they don't fight to the last man and you know, all commit suicide at the end. They surrender because he's already spared a few pirates, and you know, he's able to basically talk to these people after he defeats a few of them and make diplomatic overtures. And the overwhelming majority of the pirates end up surrendering, because rather than doing the usual Roman thing of saying, all right, we're going to kill or enslave the men and then enslave the women and children, he offers them a settlement. He says, well, we've got these depopulated lands in Greece. We've got depopulated lands in Cilicia from the pirate wars. We've got depopulated lands even in southern Italy from the recent servile wars with Spartacus that Crassus fought. I discussed in the biography I did of him on the Cost of Glory. And so they say that sounds a lot better than being slaves. And basically he makes honest men of them. Mm-hmm. And he ends up winning the pirate war, finishing it, solving the pirate problem completely that has been, you know, harrying the Roman interests for decades in 3 months. And it shocks the world. And I think for Posidonius, he could say, well, that's the power of cosmopolitanism. You know, it's about understanding the real nature of the situation and just applying that reason rigorously. So I love that story.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a case where the ethics and the pragmatics are one, I think, which is a common counsel for, I think, one gets from many ancient Greeks and Romans, which didn't necessarily make such a strong division between, you know, what's practical and what's ethical, as we do today.
Right. Yeah. It doesn't always work out that way, but
it doesn't always work out that way, certainly.
So there's one more great anecdote about Pompey and Posidonius. So Pompey goes off. After this, he ends up being entrusted with this great war with Mithridates in the east. So Mithridates is still alive after Sulla defeated him and Lucullus defeated him, but he's very slippery and he manages to survive. And anyway, long story short, Pompey wins that war. It takes a few years and he comes back on his way back to Rome. This is 63, 62 BC. And he wants to visit Posidonius, who's meant so much to him, etc. So he lands on Rhodes and he hears Posidonius is ill. He's indisposed in his house. And so Pompey makes a kind of pilgrimage to the house of Posidonius. And instead of the normal thing, if you're a victorious consul, you have these lictors, these bodyguards who carry the fasces, you know, the rod axes, symbols of power, and they're also kind of bludgeoning weapons. So the normal thing, if you know, if a consul wants to come and pay you a visit, the lictors will bang on the doors of your house with their fasces and they say, "Open up in the name of the SPQR." And so Pompey has those lictors lower all of their fasces and not do any of that, and kind of take off some of the insignia of imposing power, and he calls out politely and enters, and very, very significant sign of deference for a Roman general to do this. And then he basically has to come and visit Posidonius in bed. And Posidonius is having this kind of paroxysm of gout. He's got, you know, excruciating pain in his feet and his knees. And Pompey says, "Well, my friend, it's great to see you again. I'm so sorry that I won't get to hear you lecture, but it was so meaningful to me." And Posidonius sits up and he says, "Nonsense! Far be it from me to allow a man of your stature to come and visit me and leave empty-handed." And so he delivers. Pompey apparently liked to tell this story later in life. Cicero preserves it for us. He says, as the great man used to recount about his visit to Posidonius. So this made a big impact on Pompey. Mm-hmm. Posidonius gives him this speech about the nature of the good. He says, "Nothing is good which is not honorable." And I kind of think of that as Posidonius kind of entrusting Pompey with this key piece of wisdom that he's going to need for what he's about to face when he gets back home. Because the hardest part of being a Roman general, as you know, many generals discovered, people like Lucullus, is when you come back home, you are, especially if you're victorious, you face tremendous amounts of resentment and envy from your fellow nobles who, you know, you think you're better than us now. Like, well, because you are in the eyes of the Roman society. So Pompey's got big, big problems to face after his victorious time in the East. And that's another story that ends up with his war with Julius Caesar 10 years or so later. But I love that episode. And I think Pompey was, you know, he's not a stoic doctrinaire. He's not faithful to stoicism. He doesn't study philosophy necessarily, but he wants to be a good man. He wants to be perceived as being a just man, as a benevolent man. And I think he has some more claim to that than a lot of the great figures of the time. He has this reputation for settling disputes and being just to his enemies in the East, his former enemies at least. So I love that episode about Posidonius, again, kind of knowing what people specifically need for the trials that they face.
Yeah, yeah. And I suppose Posidonius is also an example of someone aiming to capture that truth. He's imparting, you know, what's good, what is noble, what's evil, not pain, but the lack of nobility.
And it, apparently, as he was discoursing to Pompey, he would periodically get seized by these pangs of agony, and he would just say, "Ah, pain, you may hurt, but I will never admit that you are an evil," addressing his pain as though it were something else.
Yeah, that's awesome. It's interesting because Pompey returns and in a sense does all the right things, but is not rewarded for it by the Roman aristocrats. You know, he abandons his army, not abandons, of course, but you know, doesn't march in the show of force. As far as I can tell, is relatively deferential, but it doesn't pay off.
That's right. Yeah, he has all kinds of headaches trying to get his veterans awarded and trying to get all of his settlements in the East awarded. And that's basically the Senate ends up pushing him kind of into the arms of Julius Caesar, who is a populist himself, but you know, knows how to get things rammed through the political system, whether the Senate likes it or not. And so Pompey ends up having to make some difficult compromises that people blame him for. I mean, it's the kind of things that politicians face. You know, a lot of people were counting on Pompey. So, I mean, he had his own dignity to think of, but also the interests of so many people that were counting on him. That's it was challenging to say the least. Mm-hmm.
In what ways do you think he was not a Stoic, or maybe didn't take some of Posidonius's counsel to heart? Of course, it's somewhat speculative, but where does he act in unstoic ways, if you will?
Give Pompey some credit. He was very good at controlling his emotions in the moment. He was never seen to fly into a rage at insults. You know, he was the most grand figure of his day, and people were constantly heckling him and insulting him. And I think that, I mean, and he would often just have to deal with this and face it unperturbed, like a Stoic, like somebody trying to restrain their emotions because they know the consequences of it's the classic tyrant. You know, once you reach the heights of power, you start to lose it and lash out at people. And to his credit, Pompey really kept that in check. I think I'm working on through the details of his falling out with Julius Caesar and the kind of political deadlock that ends in the civil war in 49 between the two of them that Pompey ends up losing. But he does end up basically in this position against Caesar, where in order for Caesar's in Gaul and trying to be restored back to the Republic, trying to re-enter Roman politics on his own terms. And Pompey, the Senate's trying to oppose Caesar and prosecute him when he gets home. And Pompey wants to help Caesar out, their friends, but Caesar's his junior colleague. Caesar's 5 or 8 years younger than him. And Pompey just cannot tolerate, at the end of the day, the idea of being an equal to Caesar. He will not allow Caesar to come back, and he will not help Caesar out unless Caesar shows deference, unless it's kind of on Pompey's terms. Mm-hmm. And that truncates a lot of the details. But I think, you know, there's some, I read somewhere that Posidonius spoke of Pompey's exceeding empty lust for glory later in his years. So maybe he kind of ended up disappointing Pompey later on by sort of not seeing that the thing that the state needed him to do, that the Republic needed, was for him to acknowledge that Caesar was now his equal, whether he liked it or not, because it was either that or civil war. And Pompey chose civil war. He really dug his heels in, and he might have been listening to bad advice, but that's what ended up happening.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's interesting. I suppose you do have that just drive for glory, which is just always that double-edged sword where it can be something that propels one towards a kind of greatness or virtue, but of course also carries with it, you know, these extreme risks that one overindulges in. And, you know, that's why Seneca and Marcus Aurelius are always going after ambition. You know, usually they describe it as a vice, not something that's admirable in others.
Right. Right. You might need it to achieve great things, but if it controls you, but if you aren't able to step back from it when it really counts, you might end up destroying yourself as so many great men did. So yeah, I think that one of the reasons that they talk so much about ambition is they know its power within themselves, and they're trying to restrain it within themselves.
Yeah, they know it within themselves. They also, they're in the Roman court, they probably see, you know, the most ambitious people in the world, and they can see, you know, what that does to people's character, both the positive and the negative aspects of that.
Yeah, yeah, certainly. And Posidonius himself saw a lot of this in his day. Mm.
Yeah, it's also interesting how the focus, I think, of that, what we usually translate as ambition in, say, Marcus Aurelius, is the love of others' opinions, which is not, you know, not necessarily how we use that word today. You know, I describe someone who's ambitious as someone who, you know, they're seriously dedicated to, I don't know, some project, some venture, and maybe wanting good reputation is a part of that, but it's not opinion loving. Often I think Marcus Aurelius is talking about like philodoxa or something of that sort, which is, you know, a kind of ambition, but not the same thing.
Interesting. The other Greek word that I think of most frequently for ambition is philotimia, the love of honor. Hmm. And that can be a positive word in a lot of contexts in Greek. And I think this points to the ambiguity of ambition, because in a Greek city-state, as at Rome, the way that the polity motivates action on its own behalf, motivates its great men to go and lead armies and, you know, cough up the funds for a trireme, for example, is through honoring. That's what the city can give you in exchange for your great sacrifices and your financial input to the city. And so you need people to respond to that value system of the honor economy. But people who are uncompromising in their desire for honor are also the very people that rip the city apart. So there's some kind of like opposing molecular forces of ambition, keeping it in check, maybe.
Right, right. Yeah. It's all for the equilibrium, I suppose, is what someone would say. We should, I think, also go back and highlight some ways in which Pompey was stoic and is worth emulating, I think. And one that came to mind while I was listening to your most recent episode too on his life is that relationship between him and Julia, which he seemed to take seriously in a way that was rare for many great men, taking their marriage seriously as something that, you know, deserves some amount of emulation. I think there's probably that thought that so many people in that position don't have the time or the interest to do that kind of thing. But I suppose he shows that, well, it's possible, at least for many people, to perform their role well, even at the highest levels, as it were.
Yeah, Pompey had a lifelong reputation as being a faithful husband. He was a serial faithful husband. He had five wives, but Julia was supposed to be the best. That's Julius Caesar's daughter. I think it was widely talked about that Julia is like, you know, young enough to be his daughter. And, oh, it's this old man with this young woman. Isn't that a little bit? Nah. They were talking about it in those terms in that day. But what balanced it out for public opinion was that Julia really seemed to have likewise like true love for Pompey. Like they really loved each other and they would spend time together. And it was because, as Plutarch says, Pompey was a really charming and affectionate, not just that, but faithful husband. And he took their relationship very seriously. He wanted to have children with her. He already had some children from a previous wife whom he divorced because she was unfaithful. And so he demanded that from his own wives, which was, you know, not a standard that every Roman husband upheld. And certainly not a standard that they imposed for the most part on themselves. And his, I think it's also interesting, speaking of Pompey's women, you know, he liked to have intellectuals around, even though he wasn't an intellectual himself. You know, he liked to have Cicero around. He liked to have this guy Theophanes of Mytilene around. He gave Theophanes citizenship. He was another historian, kind of a peer of Posidonius. And his last wife, Cornelia of the Metelli, she was famed for being a woman of great learning. Not so much, Plutarch comments, that she had that unappealing officiousness, which which such studies bring to young ladies. That's how they thought of it in those days, which I think is funny. But yeah, so I think he appreciates that part about Cornelia, that she that she's, you know, studying philosophy and literature, and so that you could point to that as another Stoic aspect of Pompey that, you know, even if he's not, you know, doing metaphysical problems, he likes to be around wise people. You know, he likes to get the input of people who study these things and at least hear them out.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. Do other connections come to mind along this front in ways that we haven't mentioned? Pompey's either influenced by Stoicism or put the philosophy or related ideas into practice.
Well, he was a big upholder of public religion. People think of Julius Caesar as the Venus guy. You know, he's just claimed descent from Venus, who was the mythic founding goddess, mother of Aeneas, from the Virgil's Aeneid. But Pompey was sort of the first to lay his claim to Venus of the two of them. When he got back from the East, he built this great temple complex to Venus. It actually wasn't really a temple. It was a theater, which was crowned by a little temple on top because the Romans had these laws against making permanent theaters. He built the first permanent theater for the Romans. But he called it a temple of Venus. But he had a special affinity for the goddess Venus, who was not just a goddess of, for the Romans at least, not just a goddess of erotic love, but also a goddess of charm and rhetoric. So I think that's an interesting thing to think about. And this does connect with Posidonius too, if we want to go back in that direction. Posidonius was really interested in religion himself.
Yeah, I wonder if you could say more about that. You know, interested in religion, what does that look like?
Posidonius had a take on ancient Jewish history that Moses was this Egyptian priest who got fed up with the anthropomorphism of traditional Egyptian religion and just led a kind of revolt and left Egypt and established his own religion. He didn't think Moses was a Jew per se, but that he kind of invented Judaism by starting a new religion and colonizing Judea and founding this aniconic religion in the Temple of Jerusalem. And that it in Posidonius's eyes, it later got corrupted by people who, you know, superstitious people inventing things like dietary laws and the Mosaic law. So he didn't like everything about Judaism. Yeah. And also, you know, acquisitive priestly class conquering their neighbors and such. He didn't quite approve of that, but he really appreciated, I think he had visited the temple in Jerusalem. He said, even to this day, even the nothing's perfect, and there's certainly things to object to about Judaism, they managed to instill this sense of reverence and awe that you can't get in other temples, that whenever you bring in these anthropomorphic gods like we have among the Greeks and Romans, even though Posidonius would be no advocate of abolishing them or changing public cult, he saw that, in his view at least, anthropomorphism in the divine sort of cheapened and vulgarized religion, which I think is really fascinating. But Posidonius had a really, really high opinion of divination, not of every kind of, you know, soothsaying and fortune telling practice, but he believed that people who are close to their death have particularly clairvoyant dreams if their souls are prepared. Mm. This might be a parallel that you can draw with Pompey. Actually, Pompey was noted for being kind of superstitious and skittish, and listened a little too much to the omens, in Cicero's opinion.
Got it.
But there's this great quote from Posidonius. He said, "The cause of emotions, that is, of disharmony and the unhappy life," I think emotions there, he means the pathos, "the cause of them is that men fail to be wholly consistent in following the daimon within them, the daimon or spirit that is akin to and of like nature with the power governing the whole universe." So I wonder if you could connect that with Panaetius and role ethics. For Posidonius, I think as an outgrowth of cosmopolitanism, that means that everybody kind of has their own role to play, right? And you have a unique daimon, but that daimon is also a reflection of like the divinity within. Mm. And you need to be in touch with that divine part of your nature. And where people go wrong is they listen to this part of them that is divorced from the divine, that is, you know, the irrational part of the soul, the unhappy, the godless part, as he calls it. Our lower animal principle that drives us to glory without questioning whether it's just, for example. So he had a high opinion of certain aspects of religion, not everything about traditional mm-hmm. religion, to be sure.
Yeah, I don't know. I had no idea that he had the hypothesis that Moses was an Egyptian priest. I didn't know he was either the source or one of the believers. And that's really cool.
Yeah, that's a quote at passages from Strabo, who is mm-hmm. also a practicing Stoic, but a lot of scholars agree that he's getting this from Posidonius, who he quotes extensively. It's kind of hilarious.
Yeah, that's really funny. But that thought about the daimon, that sounds like, you know, in these views about the Stoic God, where, you know, God, what is God? God is nature, but nature is understood as reason with mm. that capital R, that sort of propelling force that provides a kind of providence structure to the world. And we each contain aspects of it, a fragment of that God within us. And that's something, just exactly that, something we need to align with. And by doing that, then we are respecting our own reason and respecting, you know, the reason of nature as a whole. I think
it's
a really, really fascinating view.
And I think that this ties in with Posidonius's, I think it ties in with his very serious interest in studying the natural world and the therapeutic value of that, which is something that Nock, at least, credits as inspiring Seneca's Natural Questions, which is very much mm-hmm. in the spirit of studying nature as a form of therapy. to understand the cosmos, to remove fear, to understand the divine within you through studying the divine order of the cosmos as a, you know, expression of nature. And it could be that Posidonius, as Nock claims, it was to a large extent responsible for this uptick you see in interest in natural philosophy among Roman intellectuals. You see it in Lucretius, you see it in Virgil's Georgics. Cicero translated Aratus's Phenomena, this astronomical poem. And Nock, and his opinion is not to be sneezed at, he says, well, Posidonius kind of made this stuff cool in Rome. And I think that's a very interesting thought to consider. And another really key aspect, I think, of Posidonius as a philosopher, to kind of round it out, is, again, just this emphasis. For me, this is a big takeaway from studying Posidonius, is how important it is for philosophers to study history, to really get into the examples of the moral quandaries that great men get themselves into, and understanding the causes of things. That was a huge part of, I mean, it was a third of all of his vast voluminous writings were his histories of his times. It goes to show you how seriously he took this as an ethical subject.
Yeah, that's a great example. I think it's not something that really took root in Western philosophy for some time. This thought that you must study history, be familiar with questions of society broadly in order to do philosophy well, is something that, you know, we really don't start seeing again until Nietzsche. I think that's maybe a little bit too fast, but, you know, there is something to that, where it was many of the Renaissance characters, I suppose you see it, of course, which is a period of time that Nietzsche is inspired for. But when you think about philosophers of the Western canon, often they're not as involved in history, or at least don't connect that to their philosophy.
Yeah, you can see it some in Aristotle. Aristotle's school put together a lot of biographies, and in a way, all the constitutions that he commissioned, Constitution of Athens being one of the only ones that survives, you could see that as a sort of historical endeavor. But for the most part, I think you've got a point. Like, history is seen as not philosophy, certainly with our lens today of academic philosophy. But somebody like Plutarch.
Yeah, of course, Plutarch. I suppose, to be clear, I think the Romans took this up for sure. And Plutarch's a good example of someone who,
that's moral philosophy. It's like applied philosophy. It's sort of less serious than the stuff that you're supposed to argue about in the classroom. That is the real philosopher's stuff.
Yep. Absolutely. Excellent. Well, is there anything else you wanted to add?
This has been a lot of fun, Caleb. Yeah, I really enjoyed the opportunity to dig into Posidonius, and I think there's a chance that among the scrolls that we are able to decode now through this Vesuvius challenge, that we'll unearth some lost texts of Posidonius, and I have high hopes that that will happen at some point in our lifetimes, sooner rather than later, hopefully. But there's just such fascination to be found in his writings, and I think he could really teach us all kinds of stuff, not just about Stoicism, but about ancient peoples, lost peoples that we don't know about. Studying the Celts, the Jews, the Armenians, the pirates, etc. So, stay tuned. I hope to be following that on my own podcast and my newsletter.
Fate willing. That would be
fate
amazing.
Fate willing. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And where should people go to check out your stuff?
You can find Cost of Glory anywhere you get your podcasts. I'm on YouTube and all the platforms. On Twitter, I'm at Cost of Glory, and costofglory.com if all else fails.
Yeah, and do check out the Cost of Glory podcast. You've got those two episodes now on Pompey, I think shooting for one more, and then have many episodes on some of the other characters we mentioned.
Yeah,
Marius.
Yeah, next up will be, we didn't even talk about Cato the Younger, who was Pompey's great, I don't know, they had a troubled relationship. They were frenemies, mostly enemies, right. which is a really interesting Stoic conversation. But yeah, Cato will be next, hopefully coming out later this summer, and maybe we can have another conversation around that when that happens.
Let's do it.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks, Alex.
Enjoyed it, Caleb. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to Stoic Conversations. Please give us a rating on Apple Podcasts or Spotify and share it with a friend. If you want to dive deeper still, search Stoa in the App Store or Play Store for a complete app with routines, meditations, and lessons designed to help people become more Stoic. And I'd also like to thank Michael Levy for graciously letting us use his music. You can find more of his work at ancientlyre.com. And finally, please get in touch with us. Send a message to stoa@stoameditation.com if you ever have any feedback, questions, or recommendations. Until next time.